Today is Monday, December 21st, 2009. I'm Laurel Nemi, your host for The Wildlife, a program that probes the mysteries of the animal world through interviews with scientists and other wildlife investigators. Today on The Wildlife, I'll talk with David Higgins, a criminal intelligence officer specializing in wildlife crime at Interpol. We'll talk about the black market trade in wildlife and what Interpol is doing to stop it. The illicit wildlife trade involves thousands of different types of animals, from butterflies to birds and turtles to tigers. Thousands of species are involved. One of these is a strong and elusive predator that lives in the rainforests of Central and South America and is the subject of this week's Creature Call. Now, listen carefully and see if you can guess today's Creature Call. At the end of the show, I'll play these sounds again, tell you what kind of animal made them, and also give you a preview of next week's Creature Call. Now, let me turn to my conversation on the black market trade in wildlife with David Higgins, a criminal intelligence officer specializing in wildlife crime at Interpol. As you'll be able to tell from his accent, Mr. Higgins comes from Australia, where he worked for the Australian Government Department of the Environment. There, he was an assistant director of compliance and enforcement. Before that, he worked in Cambodia as an environmental law enforcement advisor, and in Tasmania, also in Australia, as a wildlife ranger and a police officer. Since August 2008, he's led Interpol's efforts against wildlife crime as a criminal intelligence officer within Interpol's environmental crime program. You may not know it, but killing wild animals is big business. While much wildlife trade is legal, a huge black market exists, especially in endangered species. Illegal wildlife smuggling could be worth as much as $20 billion annually and probably ranks behind drugs and human trafficking as the third largest illegal trade worldwide. Of course, nobody knows for sure how much it's worth because traffickers aren't reporting their sales figures. But the point is that wildlife trafficking is big. A new article on illegal wildlife trade in Asia that was just published in the January 2010 National Geographic magazine and written by Brian Christie, author of The Lizard King, notes that, quote, "It is almost impossible to name an animal or plant species anywhere on the planet that has not been traded, legally or illegally, for its meat, fur, skin, song, or ornamental value, as a pet or as an ingredient in perfume or medicine," unquote. And he's right. The animals targeted by traffickers run the gamut, from beetles to bears and lizards to leopards. Almost nothing is immune. The reason is simple: money. Gram for gram, animal products like rhino horn or deer musk can be worth more than gold, diamonds, or cocaine. A single chatoosh shawl, woven from the fur of five rare Tibetan antelopes, can sell for $15,000. They're valuable live, too. A pair of birdwing butterflies can sell for upwards of $8,500. And a breeding pair of black palm cockatoos can go for $85,000. The illegal wildlife trade is a big problem for several reasons. First, it's killing rare species, and doing it at a time when they're already under threat from habitat loss and climate change. The illegal trade is also a source of non-native species, which are often released into the wild where they outcompete the native species. And they can also be a source of potentially deadly and economically devastating diseases. Illegal wildlife trade has also been linked to human and drug trafficking, and, because of its high profitability and low risks, increasingly organized crime and militia groups are getting into the game. When I spoke with David Higgins, who's in charge of wildlife crime at Interpol, the international police organization, a few weeks ago, I asked him to give listeners an overview of wildlife crime.
Well, we try to simplify the definition of what wildlife crime is by saying that wildlife crime is any breach of legislation, national legislation or state or provincial legislation, that is put in place to protect wildlife resources. So that's a simplified approach. Basically, what it does mean is that if somebody goes and handles or possesses or trades in wildlife that is contrary to their legislation or against the law, then that's a wildlife crime, and that can be localized, nationalized, or internationally.
So, in the United States, there are many state and federal laws to protect wildlife. For example, many states regulate or prohibit the sale of bear parts, like bear gallbladders or bear paws, even when that bear was taken legally with a license. At the federal level, there are also several laws. Perhaps most well-known is the Endangered Species Act, which regulates not only the importation, but also the export, the taking, the possession, and the commercial trade of both endangered and threatened foreign and domestic species. There's also the Lacey Act, which is a federal law prohibiting interstate shipment of wildlife that's taken or possessed illegally. David, can you give me some examples of some of the types of wildlife crime that you've seen?
Well, all around the world, it changes depending on which region you're in. The U.S., for instance, you've got a lot of importation breaches. You've got a multicultural society, so a lot of different cultural groups want to bring certain wildlife products in to your country. That's from an international perspective, so you're dealing with the importation breaches.
So, for instance, just a few weeks ago, in late November, federal officials arrested a man at the Los Angeles airport with 15 live lizards that were strapped to his chest. He had two geckos, two monitor lizards, and 11 skinks, which are another type of lizard. All told, the 15 lizards were valued at about $8,500. So this guy was a resident of California, and he was just returning from Australia when he was caught with the smuggled animals taped to his body. And all Australian reptiles are strictly regulated, and he didn't have any permits. Now, this case isn't closed yet, and he'll be arraigned in federal court on December 21st. So that's from the international perspective. What about from the national perspective?
But from a national perspective, you're dealing with your own native wildlife and the citizens of the U.S. that may be breaching wildlife laws all around different states. But all around the world, it varies. Certain people will trade in things like parrots, reptiles. There's wildlife, traditional medicines that contain wildlife products. There's a major trade in those types of commodities.
How does the illegal wildlife trade differ in different countries?
Well, yeah, I think that every region will say that their situation is unique, and I'd definitely agree with that. They do have unique aspects. But wildlife crime is, in my view, an international issue. Whilst many, a lot more localized wildlife criminals will target particular things, such as, you know, the hunting of elk in American states. But then those same individuals may actually be foreign citizens that come over to hunt elk. You may have people trading in parrots coming out of South America and taking them to Europe. We're only touching the surface as to what wildlife crime is and to what extent it exists.
And how did Interpol first get involved with wildlife crime? Is it a new issue? Has it been going on for a long time?
Oh, I think that, wildlife crime's been around for many decades now, and Interpol first really started to deal with wildlife or environmental crime as well back in 1992 when they established a member state environmental crime committee, which means that members from every one of our 188 member countries can attend Interpol for an annual meeting to deal with wildlife crime. So their membership is always there. And they come together as an expert body to advise Interpol on what it can do or support Interpol in its activities in combating environmental crime. Now, we've linked that in to include environmental crime. We also have a group dealing with pollution crime issues and so on and so forth. So we've got a broad scope. But if we just narrow that down to deal with wildlife crime, it basically means every year experts come to Interpol or to another location. Like in September this year, we met in Brazil, and we were represented by about 60 individual countries. We all met and they discuss and develop projects. And then the Interpol core staff, which is what I'm one of, will then work with them in executing those particular projects.
So just to clarify things a little bit, because I'm not sure any of us understand how Interpol works, is in the beginning of 2006, that's when Interpol had its first appointment of a full-time desk officer to manage the wildlife crime program. And that's expanding its activities. And also within that framework, there's an Interpol Wildlife Crime Working Group, which you were just talking about, which helps coordinate the exchange of information between member countries and also supports domestic law enforcement operations. And it's that Wildlife Crime Working Group, which just recently met. It meets face-to-face every year, and it just had its 21st meeting in Manaus, Brazil in late September. And basically the idea of that Wildlife Crime Working Group of Interpol is to bring all this expertise together and help exchange all the experiences of law enforcement officers, be it on the poaching, the trafficking, or the possession of legally protected flora or fauna. So how is Interpol organized, and where does wildlife crime fit in?
Okay, well, to begin with, I suppose I'll take it back. Interpol was established back in 1923, and we're an international criminal police organization. Now, as of late, with the evolution of law enforcement in other areas such as environment or intellectual property, law enforcement has started to move out of traditional policing agencies such as the police and move into the responsibilities of other organizations like Environmental Protection Agency or U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, which have law enforcement capabilities. So Interpol has broadened its focus to engage with these types of agencies a lot better. So if we were established back in 1923, our main focus was to try and create linkages between countries, because it was identified that criminals, when they leave one country and go to another, that there was very bad communication, if not any communication, between country A and country B. So Interpol was established to try and combat and assist police agencies in the first instance to communicate and apprehend international fugitives or criminals.
And like you said earlier, wildlife crime often has an international element. Frequently, the protected animal, like a rhinoceros, will be killed in one country, and then the product, in this case the horn, may be processed either there or in a different country. And then the illicit product might ultimately be shipped across more than one country and pass through the hands of several middlemen until it finally arrives in the hands of the buyer, who may live thousands of miles away from where the animal was originally killed. Now, you said that Interpol's initial focus was on the capture of international fugitives. How has that changed?
As time has gone on, we've evolved, and as technology has been introduced into policing and governments, we've evolved to provide services to our member countries to assist in those major international exchanges. So we have secure communication channels, we've got immediate alert notices for international fugitives, and so on and so forth.
And with environmental crime, how is that international coordination really needed? Is it, how vital has it been?
Well, I suppose if you look around the world, there are some countries that environmental law enforcement still rests with the national police bodies. Brazil is a good example of that. Their national police agency is still responsible for law enforcement from an environmental and wildlife perspective. But then you look at the US, and the US has got other agencies, dedicated agencies to deal with law enforcement, like the US Fish and Wildlife.
What determines the approach that's used?
And I mean, it tends to be a bit of a cycle as to where the particular governments at the time see the best approach for combating these types of crimes. And the US at the moment obviously has, and will probably for many, 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 many years, continue down the path of dedicated agencies and services. I can't see them changing it. It's very effective.
Can you tell me a little bit more about what Interpol does?
What Interpol does is acts as a system or a framework for countries to exchange their investigative records or any intelligence about criminals from one country to another, and the storage of criminal intelligence within a central location here in Lyon, France.
What are some of the issues you have?
Now, the issues we have is that our national police agencies are our points of contact in each country. So from an environmental or wildlife law enforcement situation, you can see that if the national police agency within the US exists, which is the Department of Justice in this instance, if they're not actually obviously connected, apart from being government, with the US Fish and Wildlife Service or the Department of Interior. So there's that. We rely very heavily upon the internal connections between agencies to ensure that if the agency within the US is not connected with the agency responsible for communication through Interpol's channels, then we're not going to be able to communicate securely with them.
So in the US, is it the Department of Justice that's the member of Interpol?
The Interpol member countries have what we call a National Central Bureau. And the National Central Bureau, as rule of thumb, is generally housed within the National Police Agency or the National Law Enforcement, which basically reaches out to international linkages or is responsible for international investigative actions. So, for instance, Australia, the National Central Bureau is part of the Australian Federal Police. In your instance, in the US instance, it's the Department of Justice that houses it.
Can you tell me a little bit more about the structure of Interpol?
We have priority crime areas. We have six priority crime areas that are aimed more at the traditional policing type of roles, such as financial and high-tech crime, human trafficking, drugs and organized crime, public safety and terrorism.
Today is Monday, December 21st.
We also have what we call sub-regional bureaus, which are Interpol offices, physical offices based in certain places around the world, and they also assist on a regional basis in maintaining the communication.
Just how important is that communication?
Because communication, coordination, cooperation are really the key. You know, if without that, we have nothing. And communication actually assists in maintaining all of those. If you're not communicating, so you've got to have your staff out there talking, meeting, and facilitating the exchanges, the investigative requests, and the intelligence exchanges that occur real time, and they're happening all the time, 24 hours, 7 days a week.
And then where does environmental crime fit in?
We sit within public safety and terrorism. Obviously, environmental crime has a public safety issue. Environmental crimes, more so rather than wildlife crimes, have a human health impact. So at this stage, that's where we sit. As the threat becomes more evolved, then the likelihood of Interpol engaging at a higher level will increase.
So tell me a little bit more about the Environmental Crime Unit. How many people are in the unit?
Currently have myself, I'm the Wildlife Crime Officer. We have a Pollution Crime Officer. We have an Administrative Support Officer. And then we have another officer that deals particularly on Africa under a project called Project Oasis, which deals with enhancing the capabilities of African law enforcement agencies in Southern Africa in particular. And part of that project, which is a large project dealing with other things like human trafficking and intellectual property and general law enforcement capabilities, it also has a component that deals with wildlife, because obviously wildlife is a significant issue and a significant natural resource and natural heritage for the African continent. So, and therefore criminals are attracted to that particular resource based on the financial gain.
I just want to highlight that there are only 3 people in the world who are tasked with working specifically on wildlife crime at the international level. There's 2 of you at Interpol, namely you and your colleague, who works on what's called Project Oasis, which you just described and is focused on law enforcement in Africa. And of course, wildlife crime is a significant part of that. In addition, there's a third person who's also focused on wildlife crime law enforcement, and he's based at the Secretariat for CITES, which is the Convention on International Trade in Endangered Species. And one last thing I wanted to note is that only the CITES officer has a position funded by the institution itself. Both you and your colleague at Interpol have externally funded positions. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
Right. Interpol itself is funded via a membership type of arrangement from the member countries. So all 188 member countries make an annual contribution to Interpol Global, the Interpol General Secretariat. Our program itself, we are funded not through that system. We're actually funded via donations from non-government organisation, International Fund for Animal Welfare, and a foundation called Bosak and Kruger Foundation. We recently have had a government agency or two government agencies support us. We've had Environment Canada, and we've also, the Pollution Crime Officer is being funded by the Netherlands government. So that's, we're only a small group at this stage and with a small annual budget, but we are trying to do what we can with what we've got.
And so what are your main jobs? Because for being such a small unit, you really have a big impact.
We're trying to, whilst doing our day job, we're also trying to build and develop our program, the environmental crime program, which we now consider to need to report to deal with not only wildlife pollution, forestry or illegal logging, fisheries, natural resources, and the list goes on, climate change, crime and corruption. Now, that's a lot for such a small team, so we can only do what we do. So we're trying to build a program, seek strong partnerships from government agencies, non-government agencies or organisations, and the private sector also. So that's one of our approaches, building the program and seeking a sustainable funding.
And then what do you do on a daily basis?
We coordinate and lead international or regionally focused operational activities.
Can you give me an example?
One of our previous ones was Operation Barber, which was coordinated with our Project Oasis and our program, which targeted the domestic sale of ivory within a number of countries within the African continent.
Let me just jump in here and explain a bit about Operation Baba. A year ago, in November 2008, Interpol coordinated a one-day sweep of over 50 ivory smuggling sites across 5 countries. The code name for this blitz was Operation Baba. It was named after Gilbert Baba, who was a Wildlife Department ranger in Ghana, who was murdered by illegal wildlife dealers a decade ago. And Interpol did him proud. Operation Baba focused on local ivory markets, airports, border crossings, and other smuggling points, and led to the arrest of nearly 60 people and the seizure of 1 ton of illegal elephant ivory. All in all, it was the largest ever international wildlife law enforcement operation ever conducted in Africa to that point, and it involved over 300 law enforcement officers from numerous agencies, from the police, customs, and wildlife agencies in the 5 countries. And those 5 countries were Congo-Brazzaville, Ghana, Kenya, Uganda, and Zambia. Tell me a bit how you work with other international agencies.
Actually, last week, Interpol, World Customs Organization, and CITES, the Convention of International Trade in Endangered Species, and the UNODC, Office of Drugs and Crime, we met in Vienna last week and discussed how to enhance our international communication and cooperation, because we feel that internationally we need to start working together more effectively, and then with that we'll be able to more effectively assist all the countries that are within our membership in their efforts in combating wildlife crime. Now, this meeting was just aimed at wildlife crime. Maybe in the future it might be expanded to involve other crime types within the environmental spectrum. But we figured that it was best to attack one of these crime threats first, get that right, or get it moving in the right direction, and then we can start engaging with others.
And what's really required to enhance that international communication? What are some of the constraints or challenges?
Well, the constraints and challenges are endless, but we...
the top 10 list.
Yeah, top 10. I think it requires all countries to avoid every country wants to, needs and feels they need to have ownership on their activities externally outside the country for their own, you know, security issues, their national security issues as well. Obviously, environmental or wildlife crime do involve security issues and threats to your own country. You look at illegal logging, for instance, the amount of revenue and crime elements that are involved in the illegal transportation and harvesting of logs is phenomenal. Now, it's only natural for a country to want to engage and have ownership of those particular activities or capacity-building approaches they're doing in another country. Now, we're saying that we, to our member countries, we can assist you in that. Just by involving us in it doesn't mean you're losing ownership. In fact, means you're actually enhancing what you're trying to achieve, because you might be doing something, one country may be doing something in another. Country A may be doing something in country B, and country C may also be doing something in country B, but no countries are communicating and sharing that with them, and it's a duplication of effort. So we want to avoid the duplication of effort and the duplication of funding resources, you know, in these efforts. I think that's what the public want, and that's what we feel we're able to assist in. Not only us, we're also thinking that World Customs Organization, UNODC, and your UNEP, which is the Environmental Program in the United Nations, can also assist in better coordinating or avoiding the duplication.
And have you seen, given the budgetary and economic constraints facing most countries right now, have you seen an increase in a willingness to cooperate and coordinate because just strictly, you know, to avoid that duplication of effort and funding and to make more with what you've got? Or has there not been really an impact?
I think that in some cases it changes depending on the country. I think in some cases you've had actually withdrawal from international efforts. Some countries have had to pull back from what they've been doing because they can't financially support it anymore. Other countries have looked at ways to streamline it, to make better use of their resources or their financial contributions and their external efforts. You can just look at any particular country and you'll be able to work out what their approach is based on their government situation at the time. It's hard to put a finger on which country or what region is deciding to fully engage. I think you'll see that issues such as illegal logging are getting attention. Climate change is a significant issue that every country is engaging in and wanting to deal with the phenomenon that's occurring right now. They realise that it's not only about economic value, it's also about the survival of their environment from a climate change point of view. And from my point of view as more of a personal issue, is that we've got to look at climate change. Without climate, there is no environment, like land or water environment, and without that, there's no wildlife. But we've got to not step back and leave the wildlife law enforcement, withdraw from wildlife law enforcement and just focus on climate change, because if we've got to look at all three situations at the same time. They're all part of the ecosystem and the chain.
I'm talking with David Higgins, head of wildlife crime at Interpol. I wanted to get back to some of the operational work of Interpol and go back to talk a little bit more in detail about Operation Baba and Interpol's involvement in that.
The operation itself was a one-day operational blitz. It involved a number of African countries, and it ended up in the sea, and it was targeting the domestic sale of ivory, so in the marketplaces. They apprehended or arrested 57 individuals, and I think as the carry-on after that ended up seeing it reach over 60. So there were when you go and do operations such as this, there's always, you know, offences that get detected, and you on the day you can't report them as an arrest or a particular result. So later on, they investigate them over the next couple of weeks, and maybe other arrests or potential prosecutions are put forward, which stemmed from the operation itself. So we say around 60 individuals were arrested, and around approximately one ton of ivory was seized. Now this ivory was in, you know, trinkets and little figurines and other types of products as well. So lots and lots of little individual pieces of ivory put together added up to approximately one ton.
And so what was Interpol's role in it? Coordination. How would you go about coordinating?
Well, Interpol, we do not do investigations. We're not an investigation or investigative agency. We don't have any law enforcement powers. So we are international public servants, if you want to put it that way. And we act as advisors to our member countries, you know, providing leadership coordination. So in this instance, we came up, developed the idea of an operational activity. We drafted it up, came up with operational orders and frameworks for our member countries to be able to participate under, and scopes of the operational, so the focus. And then we engaged with our member countries in this instance or in other instances and asked them whether they were interested in participating, which creates the international linkages. So rather than one country operating in isolation, we actually try and link them up so they're actually doing the same operation at the same time, and therefore sharing and potentially sharing the intelligence based on those operations. So that's our approach, and that was our approach in Barba, and there'll be our approach in other operations in the future. We do react to other what we'd call operational activities and assist in the exchange of intelligence and also investigative assistance. For instance, Operation Oxossi, that's how I pronounce it, Operation Oxossi, which was a Brazilian operation, and that occurred over the last 2 years.
Can you talk a little bit about that operation?
Operation Oxossi was March 2008. It was first discovered that by the Brazilians that there was international syndicate working on or dealing in the illegal trade in birds and reptiles to a lesser extent.
As background, listeners should realize that each year in Brazil's Amazon, 38 million animals are stolen from the rainforest. What Colombia is to cocaine, Brazil has become to the illegal animal trade. The Amazon's vast size, limited accessibility, and abundant rare species make it a haven for illegal wildlife smuggling. Now, in March 2009, Brazilian federal police, together with Interpol, made its largest wildlife trafficking bust ever. The operation, which is called Operation Oxossi, began when an officer was investigating a human trafficking ring, and he discovered that the same group used its roots to also traffic in illegal wildlife. Ultimately, over 100 people were arrested for illegally smuggling $20 million worth of animals, and there were over 500,000 animals per year involved in this case. The case involved mostly macaws and macaw eggs that were destined for the pet trade in Europe, but many other animals were included, including two jaguar cubs. Now, several things are interesting about this case. First, 70% of those arrested had been arrested for wildlife trafficking previously. That shows that penalties are way too low. And second, the case involved arrests of everybody throughout the supply chain, from poachers to the transporters to the middlemen in Brazil to importers in the Czech Republic and elsewhere in Europe, who then sold the birds to other buyers who wanted them as pets. So tell me more about how the Brazilian Federal Police and Interpol tracked the illegally captured birds to Europe.
Part of their investigation identified that some foreign nationals were involved. So they automatically, the National Police of Brazil, engage with their National Central Bureau, which is part of them anyway. And they inform them immediately, and then that National Central Bureau of Brazil, which is in Brasilia, engaged with some of the key countries that had these citizens that were involved in this illegal trade. and started the communication, where they sought assistance actually from the Czech Republic in certain issues with their investigation, such as, you know, cultural interpretation and also language interpretation issues that they were having. From there, in March 2008, they then moved it on to got the Czech Republic officer to come over and assist them in August and progress the investigation. So there was two countries working together on dealing with this particular operation. Then they progressed it. They went their separate paths, and an investigation process takes place where, you know, they go back, assess the evidence, work out whether they've got enough evidence to do searches or to seize particular items. And in March this year, Brazil was ready and had collected enough information to be able to execute somewhere in the vicinity of 140 search warrants.
Wow.
They identified six foreign nationals that they had enough evidence on to arrest or to extradite if they are in a different country. And then they, on the 11th of March, the Brazilians actually executed their operation, which conducted their 140 search warrants and arrested somewhere in the vicinity of 100 people, individuals, and seized something like 3,500 wild particular individual birds, I believe.
Then what happened?
From there, they engaged directly with the, put out what we call red notices, which is like, it's not an international arrest warrant, it's an international alert to say that an individual is wanted in another country. It doesn't actually have any statutory power to be able to arrest upon it. It all comes back to the country's bilateral agreements with each other.
What do you mean?
So if a person is walking through the US and had a red notice on them, they'll be flagged immediately, and the country, the US, would assess which country is making the request and do they have an extradition treaty with them, and is this matter something that the US would want to assist in an extradition of with a person.
Very complicated. So it's looking, but
it doesn't happen all at once. It happens over a, you know, a period of time.
And the foreign nationals were the buyers of these products and distributing them across.
Well, they were involved in one way or another in the network. Yes, some of them were probably purchasing in Brazil and exporting them back to their own country. And then what they were doing with them is up to the national body itself. But, you know, in general, they're probably possessing some, selling others on, just like other breeders may be doing completely legally within our countries, you know, the exchange of genetical pools and so on and so forth with other breeders.
So Interpol was involved in helping to coordinate the initial relationship between Brazil and the Czech Republic, as well as the red notices and whatnot.
Yeah, our secure communication channels were used to exchange all this information between the countries. They were making requests of each other constantly and not always communicating it with us, which they, you know, we don't need to communicate it all the time. So they're asking and for further information on individuals bilaterally between each country. And then when it came to the issuing of notices, they come to us and make application for the issuing of a red notice, and we will then issue, based on its merits, issue the red notice and then publish it.
Could anyone see these red notices?
And most of the cases, our red notices aren't viewable to the general public. They're only viewable to the National Central Bureau or police agencies that are connected to our secure systems.
Okay.
So some customs agencies at the border connected, and as technology advances, you know, the linkages are occurring where it's happening real time, whereas an individual, you walk through the immigration or border control point and your passport will alert them that there's an international red notice on you.
Hopefully then, not, but...
No, I'm sure there's not with you. Exactly. And not with me either, but, you know...
So tell me a little bit more about the process of information sharing between agencies.
Well, that, if you're talking about wildlife law enforcement agencies, that opens up another can of worms from our point of view, because if they're not part of the National Police or part of the organization that houses our National Central Bureau, then we need to help them in getting the linkages between them as a National Wildlife Law Enforcement Agency with their National Police, so they can, one, start exchanging intelligence and information and requests internally within the body, within the nation, and then they'll be able to start using the Interpol systems and channels to communicate with other countries. So there's two different types of networks and coordinational efforts that we need to do. We need to ensure they're introduced internally within the nation, and then we can link them into our 188 member countries internationally.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, and that seems to that's with the evolution of wildlife or environmental law enforcement into other agencies. That is the problem. When they move, the communication and relationship in the country didn't actually necessarily stay there. So we need to make sure it's there for them to use our systems,
and usually,
which is appropriate.
Yeah, and it's not sort of typically automatically there. It's something that has to be.
It is in certain countries, and sometimes when using something, you know, you may have a really good relationship and then, you know, staff movements occur and, you know, 5 years down the track you haven't communicated with the national police for a while and new staff are there. So it's a matter of reintroducing. The formal relationship may exist, but the informal relationships have deteriorated because officers have left. So it's also, you've got the formal, but you've got the informal to worry about. You've got to ensure that regular communication is occurring, so they're all familiar with each other. And then, I mean, it's hard to use something when you don't even know it exists, for instance.
And so is that one of the purposes of the Wildlife Crime Working Group meeting?
Yeah, exactly that point. It's a network to educate us and inform us of what's happening in our countries, within our countries that we represent, and how we can work with them to combat the crime. But it's also about educating the members that attend about what Interpol is, so they can take it back to inform their colleagues in their agencies.
So just to back up, what is the Wildlife Crime Working Group and who's in it?
Right. Well, I mean, the membership is open to 188 member countries of Interpol. As to who physically turns up every year, we're looking at somewhere around 60, around 60 countries actually, and we're talking between 60 to 80 individual officers at any one time. However, this has grown. 10 years ago, the number would have been 35 to 40 individual officers and maybe only 40 countries or so. So as we enhance our communication externally, basically marketing and communication, we get more countries engaged. And as environmental crime and wildlife crime is even more recognized on a governmental level, involvement also increases when governmental interest is there.
How important is the informal exchange and the personal connections?
It's only human nature that if you're going to give something to somebody, you want to know who it is that you're giving it to. We are trying to say or educate our members that it's not about the individual. It's great to have the individual contact, and we need that. But if we've got to create the organisational relationships as well, so which is full in what we call institutionalisation of environmental crime. Basically, member countries and their relevant agencies need to be able to continue knowing that they can communicate with, so Australia Department of Environment can communicate with the US Fish and Wildlife Service. But as soon as we base it just upon individuals within the agencies, all it takes is one individual to leave and then we've lost that entire relationship. So we're actually talking about introducing and maintaining the agencies themselves. So it's institutionalization rather than... So informal is important, but we've got to follow it up with the formal. So that sounds very bureaucratic.
And I guess how is that done? Because it is so critical.
Well, I actually focus on a particular approach, which is just practice. A police officer trains in the use of their firearm regularly, and it becomes what we call muscle memory, because it needs to become an instinct to deal with it. And so in dealing with introducing and maintaining the institutionalizational approach, it needs to be practiced. These countries need to continue using a system so that just becomes ingrained in the organization that when they need to exchange information or intelligence with another country, they go to the international agencies that are established to do that. Interpol, you've got World Customs Organization, and you've got other United Nations bodies that can assist in certain exchanges. But I think that there may be a lack of awareness within many of our countries as to what we do. You know, people think Interpol and they, you know, they're a little bit apprehensive about engaging with us. Traditionally, I think we've probably been considered with the movies and whatnot as more spies and a little bit secret squirrels. And that's not the case. We're here to assist. We only exist because the member countries wanted us to exist in the first instance. So we need to remain relevant and provide the service that the member countries want.
Is Interpol used for maintenance of long-term databases on wildlife seizures or things like that?
We more are used on an operational need basis. So it's like the matter is here right now that they've just apprehended somebody. They then ask country B to assist, and the exchange happens, and the case is gone. So, you know, there's no more information required. So they're dealing with an operational physical activity that occurs here and there, an investigation as such, rather than more of a proactive approach at this stage. In time, we'll move into being more of a proactive approach where we just don't have the resources at this stage to fully engage.
And what would a proactive approach look like?
Well, I suppose, when you're dealing with law enforcement, you talk about things such as intelligence-led policing. So it's about preempting what the criminals are about to do or are doing rather than picking up the pieces after they've done it.
What does that look like?
So it's really just it's intelligence sharing and then analyzing of that intelligence.
What is your background and how did you get involved in wildlife crime in the first place?
Yeah, I can't talk to you about that. Yeah, it always seems to wake the people up, you know. And anyway,
Makes it more interesting.
I've got a strange accent, so I'm not American. I come from a place called Australia, which some of you may have heard of. Anyway, I started off in a little state called Tasmania in my career as a police officer in that state, in one of our state police, or our only state police, Tasmania Police. And then I moved from there into wildlife law enforcement as a game warden, or a wildlife ranger as we call them. From there, I did a little stint in the Australian Customs Service and also overseas in Cambodia. Then I returned and my last position was for the Australian Department of Environment, where we dealt with wildlife, natural resource crimes, fisheries, not fisheries as such, but more protected area management within the marine reserves and marine mammals.
And then were you involved, say, in the National Central Bureau in Australia and then eventually moved to Interpol in France, in Lyon?
No, a National Central Bureau in Australia is part of the Australian Federal Police. And I would have needed to have been an Australian Federal Police officer to be part of that. But I'm based over here in Interpol more as an Interpol employee than a seconded officer. We have seconded officers that are still technically attached to their home agencies, and I'm not attached to my home agency anymore. I'm not part of them. So I am an Interpol employee.
And if somebody is interested in wildlife law enforcement and getting into that field, well, how would you advise them? What sorts of education did you have that got you into that? Were you always interested in wildlife? Did you study biology, or did you get into it through the law enforcement side?
I studied science at university, and I think back when I was graduating, there weren't so many jobs around. You know, probably a bit the same as now, but, you know, 5 years ago, there were jobs everywhere, and now there's not so many. So when I joined the police, I joined not because I wasn't interested, but I joined because there was a great job opportunity and career opportunity there. But my passion was always the environment, working in the environment or doing something with wildlife, etc. I grew up on a farm, so that tends to shape you a bit. So from there, I moved into that based on just my, I had some experience, but based on my passion. So my advice to other people would be to engage with their local game warden or wildlife conservation officer and speak with them. And you've got people, you've got excellent people within the states of the US as well as the federal level that will fully engage with you. Well, they have with me anyway, so I hope they will with everybody else. But they're really professionals from what I've seen. The US tends to be leading the world with its efforts with regards to wildlife law enforcement. From what I've seen, I mean, you've got a lot of staff and resources based into combating these issues. You've got a large amount of natural resources with regards to wildlife.
And I guess another question is regarding what some of the challenges to wildlife enforcement, wildlife law enforcement, are. I mean, here in the U.S., we often actually hear a lot about understaffing and underfunding of the wildlife law enforcement agencies, and it's getting worse, or it's gotten worse,
yeah,
more recently, and the lack of priority. And I guess I wanted to ask you how that can be addressed, or how Interpol faces that as well, or
we're facing that too. They're not the wildlife law enforcement agencies that say they're lacking in resources and lacking in staffing. They're actually telling the truth. Lo and behold, they are telling the truth. They are, for sure. And I think a lot of it may have to do with the fact that wildlife tends to be a victimless crime. That may get people's hair on the back of their head to stand high, but it's a victimless crime because it's not actually affecting us. It only affects us when we're told that there's only, let's go to Asia in particular. If we're told there are only 10 tigers left in the world, then do we become passionate about it. Oh my gosh, there's 10 tigers left. We've got to do something about this. How did it ever get to that state? Well, that's because you weren't thinking about it before. Now there's only 10, you are. Different. If you compare that to a common burglary in your house, you come home after work and your house has been broken into. You're emotional. You demand that an agency comes, a police agency, to deal with this issue and to do what they can to apprehend it. You're emotional. Whilst obviously wildlife are very important to us and to all of us, it's because we're not seeing it on a daily basis and we're not actually the direct victim that it doesn't get to the next level. So therefore, it tends to slip off the list a little bit more.
What could people do to change that?
I think many of the, the non-government organisations and our government organisations that do awareness raising on the importance of wildlife conservation and sustainability are doing more than enough. And whatever I say is not necessarily going to add to it. It's really about constantly reminding yourself that, the animals that exist with us, we share this planet with them, and we're sort of custodians for them. If we let other people within our, society exploit these, then they're actually exploiting it and they're stealing it from you and your collective country. It's your resource. It's not about a monetary resource. It's about your resource aesthetically as well. I mean, whatever value you place on wildlife, it can be money, it can be the fact that you're just extremely passionate about them. And it's about what value you place on them, unfortunately, and that changes per individual. It's such a huge topic that I don't think I could convince anybody, but I mean, to me, I look at it as being wildlife that's their life, and it's the property of the nation to do what they can to, ensure that they are cared for in a sustainable manner.
And is there some way listeners could support Interpol or move it, in the political priority list?
I think one thing that the listeners need to consider is when anybody talks about environmental management or wildlife management, they need to consider what management is. Obviously, management is you develop a policy or a law, you enact it, and you manage that. And part of management deals with enforcing it. Like if you develop a law in your own office, this is the way that the stationary cabinet should be managed, then somebody needs to ensure that people do it, which is what law enforcement is. Now, if you build up law enforcement to deal with wildlife crime, you need to consider, well, who are the doers? One, you've got the states. You've got your game wardens on the ground. If you don't have any of them, then you're not going to, then there's not going to be any need for an international response. So you've got to have them. If you're going to have them, then you also need a national perspective. So you've got to have an adequate one of them, a national perspective. But if you don't have a national perspective, there's no point having an international one. So you've got to look at it from all three tiers, both your state, then your national, and your international. And all of them have to be to the level that actually effectively provide a service to each other, because we're all working together on the same issue. And the public are stakeholders as well. I mean, it is their wildlife. The wildlife is their own. The wildlife are always going to be themselves. But we are their custodians to do what we feel is appropriate.
Well, that's a great way to end this segment. I really appreciate your taking the time to talk with me and look forward to talking with you again soon.
No problem. It was a pleasure.
I hope you enjoyed that conversation about Interpol and the black market trade in wildlife with David Higgins, a criminal intelligence officer specializing in wildlife crime at Interpol. Now, let me play you today's creature call once again and see if you've guessed it correctly. As you may have suspected, the animals that make these sounds are a type of medium-sized cat. Do you know what kind? It's a jaguar. Jaguars are the biggest feline in the Americas and the third largest in the world after tigers and lions. Their common name comes from the Indian word jaguar, which means he who kills with one leap. They look a lot like leopards, except that they're stockier and have shorter and more muscular legs. During the 1960s and 70s, about 15,000 or more jaguars were killed for their dramatic fur. Now, their total populations range somewhere between 10,000 and 20,000. They're classified as a near-threatened species, and they're also protected under the Convention on International Trade in Endangered Species, Appendix 1. Once again, here's the growl of a jaguar. For next week's Creature Call, I'll move to Vermont, where this common mammal lives. Here's your preview of a sound that these animals make to intimidate others of their kind and prevent fights. Be sure to tune in next week when I'll replay this strange sound from the wild world and reveal the animal that made it. Next week, I'll also talk with former Vermonter Nancy Basilchuk, a freelance science writer and editor now living in Norway who used to work the environmental beat at the Burlington Free Press. In the spirit of the season, we'll talk about wild reindeer, her search to find them on a dramatic cross-country ski trek in Norway, and whether these animals really can fly. Archived episodes of The Wildlife are available on iTunes, at my website, laurelnemi.com, and at laurelnemi.podbean.com. You can stream The Wildlife live at theradiator.org every Monday from 1 to 2 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. And, of course, if you have comments about this show or ideas for future ones, you can email me at laurel@laurelnemi.com. This has been The Wildlife. I'm your host, Laurel Nemi, and you're listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMM LP, in Burlington, Vermont.